What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guest on this week's episode is economist David Rosenberg. David is the founder and president of Rosenberg Research, an economic and financial market consulting firm that provides advice to thousands of retail and institutional clients across 40 countries. David and I spend the first hour of today's conversation discussing his economic philosophy, as well as his own experience working in the finance industry since the early 1980s, and what that experience taught him about markets, banking, and the economic cycle. We spend the second half of our conversation focused on very specific sectors of the economy, like the resource sector, housing, and commercial real estate. We also discuss the impairment of bank balance sheets that has resulted from the Fed's dramatic tightening of interest rates, and how that impairment resembles the crisis that hit the savings and loan industry in the late 1980s and early 90s. If you want access to that part of the conversation, and you're not already subscribed to Hidden Forces, you can join our premium feed and listen to the second half of today's episode by going to hiddenforces.io/subscribe. All of our content tiers give you access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, which includes Q&A calls with guests, access to special research and analysis, in-person events, and dinners, you can also do that on our subscriber page. And if you still have questions, feel free to send an email to info@hiddenforces.io, and I or someone from our team will get right back to you. Lastly, because this conversation deals with investing, I want to make absolutely clear that nothing I say on this episode can or should be viewed as financial advice. All opinions expressed by me and my guest are solely our own opinions and should not be relied upon as the basis for financial decisions. And with that, please enjoy this extremely insightful and educational conversation with my guest, David Rosenberg. David Rosenberg, welcome back to Hidden Forces.
It's been a long time, so great to be back on the show. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's been ages. We were just reflecting on that. Actually, you were on the show in the summer of 2019. That was episode 92 for people that haven't had a chance to listen to it. I definitely recommend going back to that. So, but for people that didn't hear it or for people that aren't familiar with you or Rosenberg Research, I would love for you to take a moment to describe what you do, your approach to understanding markets and the economy, and most importantly, what sets that approach apart from the crowd?
Right. Well, look, I started my career almost 40 years ago and have been both on the buy side and the sell side. So I've worn both hats and learned a great deal about the experience. I mean, ultimately, you know, when I left Merrill Lynch in 2009, I had all sorts of people coming up to me and asking me to back me to partner up and start my own research shop. But frankly, at that point, after being in the wilderness for so long and traveling all over the world, I really wanted to reestablish my relationship with my young family at the time. And also I had this opportunity to work at Gluskin Sheff, which is this boutique buy-side mutual fund in Toronto. And I figured back then, maybe you can teach an old dog new tricks and figure out what wealth management is all about. And it was a terrific experience. I mean, I would actually say that the 12 years I had at Gluskin Sheff, I probably learned more than I did in all my years combined when I was on the sell side. And the reason for that is, you know, in my previous incarnation as the chief economist of Merrill Lynch, you know, you fly around the world, you go in boardrooms, you speak to portfolio managers and CIOs, and they become nameless faces and faceless names. And you go from one boardroom to another, to another, to another, at the airport, go to another city, do the same thing, wash, rinse, repeat. And then you think because you're a master of the universe, you know, they say check your ego at the door, but it's easier said than done. But you think you have it all figured out. And it wasn't really until I started working at Gluskin Sheff, where I'm there every single day with the portfolio managers and the CIO every day. And then you're seeing the money being put to work. You know, when you're a chief economist or strategist of one of these big banks, you're several degrees removed from where the root of the money is. And so when you actually meet the families and the institutions, the people that are entrusting you with the money, and even though I wasn't running the money, but I was the trusted economic advisor and strategist, you bear this overwhelming responsibility. You're so much closer to it. So you take that much more care in what you're doing, besides just being a big name trying to get notoriety and attention as a Wall Street guru. Totally different level of burden of responsibility, and I figured that out right away. But you see, when you're there with the portfolio managers, sitting right next to them day in, day out, what you realize is that it's not about returns. It's about risk-adjusted returns. And so I learned a lot about the importance of pricing risk. And so when you're saying, you know, what sets me apart from my competitors, well, how many other people out there had the experience on the sell side and on the buy side? And I figured after 12 years at Gluskin and Sheff, and after building up a repository of my own clients, because Gluskin and Sheff actually allowed me to sell my research to outside parties, and we split the proceeds 50-50. So when push came to shove, and after being there for 12 years, and of course, Gluskin and Sheff got bought out by a private equity firm called Onyx, which really didn't want me to publish as much as I was, but that's really my stock and trade. I figured now was the time to start my own business, had the capital to do it with no outside help. And I knew that I was starting off with a global, I mean, you know, we have clients in 40 countries. And I started off the business with 1,600 clients, and now we're up to almost 3,000. And it's been a phenomenal experience, you know, running my own business and being able to call my own shots. I'm not the sort of person that was ever really constrained completely when I was at a big bank or when I was at the buy side. But you're always incentivized to, and pressured to some extent, to tie your calls into pitching product. And I was never completely comfortable with that. But then again, as an at-will employee, your boss says jump, you say how high. But you see, now I'm no longer encumbered in pitching product. I'm only now pitching my ideas. And by the way, I don't claim to be any better an economist or strategist than anybody else that's out there. There's lots of brilliant people doing what I do. But I've always had this, I don't know, I mean, I've been called a savant before. I've got this uncanny ability, I have to say, that I developed being mentored by truly great people on Wall Street and on Bay Street in Toronto, connecting the dots between the macro economy and what it means for the financial markets. And I learned at a young age to always attach my economic forecast to a market call. And so that is really, I think, to some extent, what set me apart, was trying to take the data points and formulate a cogent and cohesive investment strategy out of it. What I learned the most, I'd have to say, in those 12 years on the buy side before I started my own business, was on the first day at Gluskin Sheff, the CIO asked me at a meeting after I told the firm and I unveiled all my base case forecasts, and he said to me, well, what's plan B? I said, what do you mean by plan B? They said, well, this is your base case forecast. If you're wrong, and since you're human, you're more likely to be wrong, what's the fallback plan? Like, what's the next base case scenario after your top base case scenario? And then the scenario after that, the scenario after that. And I quickly learned, and this is the case for my clients, because my clients are not academics. My clients are all investors. And I realized right away, and this is what I think a lot of other economists don't really understand, is you can get pigeonholed into your base case view without ever telling people where you think your blind spots may be. I spend most of my day not just answering client questions, But I spend most of my day trying to figure out where are my blind spots? Where am I going to be wrong? And if I'm wrong, in what direction? So I realized after being told that if you don't have a plan B, you don't have a plan, I realized that the brain, the mindset of a portfolio manager, of a CIO, of anybody managing money, is just this distribution curve of possible outcomes. And I realized in this business, you can't rule anything out. It's about identifying what's the fat tail, what's the thin tail. If I'm wrong, where am I going to be wrong? And not just what is plan B, what's plan C, plan D, plan E. So it's all about attaching probabilities to these different scenarios, because each scenario carries with it a different risk reward attribute. So that's really what I learned. And I portray my forecast today in a completely different way than I did back when I was, say, at Merrill Lynch, where it's all point forecasts. It's all about your point forecasts on bond yields, on the Fed funds rate, on the S&P, on GDP growth, without understanding that what you leave on the table is what is your next best case scenario and the one after that. So that's really what it boils down to, is the understanding. And what I instill in my own staff is the necessity to understand that what we're doing is trying to identify what the distribution or probability curve looks like for every forecast, and to identify at all times if we are wrong, in what direction and what the magnitude would be. And I also learned something else, which is that there is no room to be stubborn in this industry. I mean, you have to have your view. You have to back up your view. You should consistently be looking not for corroborating evidence for your view, but you should be always looking for non-corroborating evidence, which means always looking for blind spots, which means that hubris and ego and arrogance have to be left at the door. So you have to be firm, but you have to be flexible. And the one thing I did learn after being with portfolio managers for so long, like every single day, 24/7, was I realized, and I wish I would have had the opportunity to do this earlier in my career, but obviously it hasn't really hurt me too much. But, you know, we're always learning, and I'm still learning at the age of 62 every single day, that we have to be disciplined in this business. I was amazed at the level of discipline of the portfolio managers at my previous shop at Gluskin Sheff. And I said to my team at the time, and I preach to my team today, we have to be as disciplined as the clients that we cater to, the people that manage money for a living. And that means that you can't hang on to a bad forecast any longer than a portfolio manager hangs on to a bad position. You have to cut your losses. If we have to change forecasts or go to plan B or plan C, then that's what we have to do once we've accumulated enough evidence that we were wrong. And then the important thing is to learn from your mistakes, and then to tell the client base what we learned from this experience and why we're not going to make that mistake again. So that, I think, sets me apart is more, I think, more the EQ than the IQ aspect of this business, understanding the level of responsibility you have as an economist and a strategist to serve your client base. And that means to have not just one forecast, but a fallback plan if it goes awry. And what are the trigger points that will cause you to change your view? Because if your view never changes, then you're basically irrelevant. And so that's basically what my approach is. I try to take the approach how a portfolio manager or an investor treats their portfolio and the way that they structure their investment thesis. We have to do the same thing when it comes to our economic projections.
Wow. This is not the conversation I was expecting to have, but now I ended up writing down a bunch of other questions for you, David. So we're going to get a little sidetracked, but I love everything you said. You know, we've done a number of episodes where we try to grapple with this. There's one in particular that comes to mind with Margaret Heffernan, whose book, Uncharted, How to Navigate the Future, is all about how we can't predict the future, but we can prepare for it. And dealing with it as a set of probabilities is a more honest and proximate way of grappling with that uncertainty. I also love what you said about this notion of a plan B, because in other parts of our lives, let's say if we have a career that we're really gunning for, or we've started a company that we're investing ourselves in, I think in those kinds of situations, having a fallback plan can actually hurt you, because it gives you an illusion of safety when in fact you should be all in on the opportunity. But as you said, in investing, it's not about returns. It's not about total returns. It's not about the returns. It's about risk management. And so actually the first question I jotted down when you were giving that answer was, what is risk? I'm curious how you define risk. How do you think about it in order to be able to manage it?
Well, I think there's really two variables that you want to focus on. The one is the degree of volatility that you want to have in your portfolio and asset mix. What are you willing to tolerate? And that'll also come down to what is your time horizon? It's called the know your client rule. What's your time horizon? And what is your preparation for the extent of volatility that you're willing to tolerate in your investments? And then what's even more critical than that is the risk of capital impairment. So the risk of a loss. And so that's where you're always trying to balance. I suppose that we can talk about Sharpe ratios till we're blue in the face. But ultimately, what you want to focus on in any particular forecast that you're going to apply to a call on the markets is, what is the impairment to capital on being wrong versus the probability of capital appreciation if you're right? And that's always the balance. So really, it's a matter of, and this is how Gluskin Sheff ultimately used me and my team and my forecasts, was trying to estimate as best they could, portfolio by portfolio, what is the extent of the possible drawdown, and what is the probability of the capture of the upside across the whole continuum of that particular forecast in the market environment. So that's really what it comes down to, is trying to do what would be referred to as an expected return. And that's what we're talking about. What is the expected return in a particular investment that you benchmark against any possible environment that we're in the economy and in the markets? So that's what it comes down to. What is that blended expected return?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we mean really when we're talking about risk-adjusted returns. You want to adjust for volatility, but you also want to adjust for the capital impairment, which is one of the reasons why people say to me, they label me a perma bear. But it's not quite right, because anybody in the fixed income crowd will always know me as a perma bull. And it's interesting because the bond market's bigger than the stock market. But, you know, when you turn on CNBC or you turn on Fox Business or Bloomberg, it's 90% about what the stock market's doing. We're just always enamored by the stock market. But equities are just one part of the capital structure, right?
Is that because you can tell a bigger story around a stock and you can't tell the same kind of story around a bond?
Well, I think that it's just basically that, you know, a bond ultimately will mature at par. Your returns in the bond market will never be as spectacular as the best possible stock you could buy. I mean, in theory, the returns in a given stock could be infinite. So bonds, basically a different way of saying that stocks will always be sexy. That won't change.
Yeah.
And bonds will always be boring. That won't change. But bonds, through thick and thin, will always be a ballast in the portfolio, because unlike a stock, you know what you're getting paid on maturity. There's just that safety and guarantee and ballast in the portfolio. But we're getting into talking about asset mix. I'm trying to give, whether it's the asset mix,
sure,
60-30-10 or 60-40, however you want to define it now. It's hard to even define what an appropriate asset mix is because there's so many alternatives today. But when you're talking about how you define risk, really it comes down to the extent of volatility. This comes down to talking to really, I mean, even today's clients, a lot of people that were reading my research when I was at Gluskin are my clients today. How much volatility do you want in the portfolio? What is your tolerance for capital impairment if it happens over a period of time? Don't forget, In rough periods, you get a mark to market. And that comes down to really the most important question I always ask people to this day, which is, what is your time horizon? I guess you can also ask, you know, what are your return expectations? But, you know, return expectations are already super inflated. In a bull market, you know, when everybody thinks they're brilliant, yeah, I want to make 20% a year. You know, and then in a bear market, you know, flat is the new up. I'm just happy with flat. And the truth is always somewhere in between. But the time horizon, tolerance for volatility, and to me, the most important thing is, and especially because Gluskin Sheff was really a mutual fund that attempted at all times, in all markets, bull markets, bear markets, or neutral, to make money. So it's really about how you can generate positive returns. Certainly not participate in drawdowns, which might happen, but the compensation is that you will make up for it by capturing the return potential on the upside.
So in order to manage risk, you have to have a view. And it feels like people don't have any problem having a view today. People have all sorts of views on all sorts of things that they don't know anything about. How important is it that you have an informed view? Let me be specific when I say informed view, that you understand why you have the view that you have, and then that you also understand why you own the things that you own, especially in an environment where many of the assumptions that people have that they're not even aware that they have are challenged or change.
Well,
and I think it's important what I'm trying to get at here. And it has to do with research and it has to do with understanding. The thing that I find value about learning, and you mentioned earlier that you're always learning, and I think it's so important to approach life as a student and to constantly learn, because the more we understand and the more we understand about why we understand what we understand or think we understand, I think it makes us better investors and it makes risk management in general in our lives a lot easier. And so anyway, that was kind of what I was trying to get at, because you know, I spend so much time reading other people's research. You put out an enormous amount of research. And so I guess that was kind of why I was asking the question.
Well, look, it's a pretty broad question. It's a, look, I consider myself first and foremost a historian and an economic historian. I also consider myself to be somewhat of a quasi-psychologist and philosopher. And I'm very well read. And
as is evidenced by your bookshelf behind you.
Well, that's actually a mural. No, I'm just kidding.
But no, you're zooming in from a Barnes & Noble.
Well, look, I think it's very important to be informed. It's not just about how intelligent you are. You got to stay informed. And you have to know your history, because although lightning never strikes twice, patterns reemerge, which is why they're called cycles. And so I would say that on top of that, I had some great mentors in my life. And one of them was Bob Farrell, the Dean of Technical Research at Merrill Lynch. And I learned a great deal from him, and I still do. And his 10 market rules to remember. And I would say that everybody on the call should Google Bob Farrell's 10 market rules to remember, which I write about constantly. I've done a couple of my own economist interpretations of Bob Farrell's 10 market rules to remember. And quite often, I will take the time to take some of the rules or all the rules and apply it to the market condition that we have in our hands right now. So I'm just basically just well-grounded. And that's because I had great mentorship in my life. I had Warren Jeston, who was the guy that hired me at the Bank of Nova Scotia back in the mid-1980s, Don Cox, who was the CIO of Harris Bank out of Chicago. Bob Farrell was vital to my thinking. So it wasn't just all me. I am and always have been a student of the economy and the markets and how the two are intertwined. Well-grounded means this, means that Bob Farrell's rule is that there are no new eras. Excesses are never permanent. So I never got sucked into the vortex that the inflation we've seen was going to be permanent. And I still don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go into the reasons why. But, you know, there are just some basic tenets that I use as groundwork for my views.
Yeah.
That are rooted in the historical record. And so when we're talking about risk, yeah, you know, I think that if you don't know your history. And what was it Warren Buffett famously said? That the one thing we learn from history is that people don't learn from history. So if you don't have historical knowledge of what makes cycles, and there's the rate cycle, there's the market cycle, there's the economic cycle, they are these typical forces, these sine waves over time that intersect with each other. If you don't have an understanding of history, then you'll be lost. So that's the first thing that I'll say with respect to your question. The other one, which comes down to what I say all the time, which is that I will always take EQ over IQ, which means what? It's what I said earlier. Hubris, arrogance, and stubbornness are left out the door. You don't stick with a stale forecast longer than you have to. You fall in love with your partner. Don't fall in love with your forecast. That is extremely vital. And you have to lay down the markers as to what happens. What has to happen for you to change your mind? You know, the best thing about my business is this. We have an information line. To my nearly 3,000 clients, they can actually email. I spend a third of my day answering emails. And so it's a great learning process for me at the same time. But I'll tell you that nobody's perfect. I don't even know what my track record after four decades even looks like. You know, you asked me before about, you know, talking about my history or what makes me different. I mean, I don't know. I can't climb in the heads. I mean, I can read other people's research. I don't necessarily always know what the thought process was to get their conclusions. But the one thing I'm just going to say is what is necessary to be successful in this business is humility. And maybe, I don't know if I learned it at an older age, I'm not sure, but humility, being humble at all times. And it's what you said before, you know, when you made the quote about the future. Absolutely right. I mean, I'm in the forecasting business. And the best quote of all time maybe didn't even come from Warren Buffett or from Bob Farrell. Maybe it came from
Yogi Berra,
right?
There you go.
Making predictions is difficult, especially when it comes to the future.
Yeah.
Which is why humility is extremely important.
No, I couldn't agree more. So look, let's show rather than tell. Let's go through your research, David. Before we do that, before we zoom out and look at the macro picture, which is what really I had prepared for, I want to at least speak to the latest news around Credit Suisse's acquisition. I know you're not a bank analyst, so I'm not asking for anything like that. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about where this fits in within the larger credit and business cycle that you cover so much.
Well, I think that it is separate from what's happening in the U.S. right now, which is very problematic. I think that the situation, look, let me ask you the question. Who was focusing on Silicon Valley Bank? I mean, even Powell wasn't, obviously. It didn't come up in any conversation during his two-day congressional testimony when all he talked about was higher for longer and the need possibly to increase the pace of raising rates. None of what happened in his own backyard came up for discussion. So I'm just going to say to you, come on. We've been talking about Credit Suisse for many, many, many years. We knew that it was a bank that was in trouble for a long time. I had a lot of my own clients telling me that this was a bank that was going to fail months ago. So it was, if you want to talk about idiosyncratic, yeah, Credit Suisse, I'm not going to say that it had gaping balance sheet hole, but it clearly was a bank in decline. And it's not the first time that UBS and Credit Suisse were getting to the altar together. They tried to do that, I think, back about 15 years ago. Oh, but interestingly enough, the regulators back then didn't want to have too much concentration of Swiss banks. So, no, we can't have that merger. Oh, but when it comes time to saving the system, no, we better have this merger or it's really the takeover. You know, what's the learning lesson here is look how complex the banking system has become. As if, you know, I'm not so sure that we solved this coming out of the great financial crisis, but look how complex it was. And UBS, you know, they had 2 days to do due diligence. And then all these life support and contingencies from the Swiss National Bank to get this deal done. And then something 81. Brand new, which is, you know, these bonds. All of a sudden, we learned that, oh, if you're a bondholder, no matter how risky the bonds were or whether they were convertibles, you think, why I'm lining up in a safer part of the capital structure, notwithstanding, they're zero. And then what do you learn? You learn that a bank that was valued at $8 billion on Friday is down to $3 billion on Sunday. What does it tell you? It tells you that, you know, we are in a fast-moving environment where investors are shooting first, asking questions later. We learn that not every bondholder is actually safe. And I don't think this has any correlation with the U.S. This was actually something very specific. But there is a learning lesson here, too, as to what a bailout could possibly look like, and that not every single part of that capital structure is completely safe. That's what I come out of it with. I don't think there's going to be runs on big European banks. I think the timing is very interesting in the sense that it is coinciding with what's happening in the U.S., which I think is something that is different and not necessarily just going to be idiosyncratic as we move forward.
Well, that's kind of where I'm getting at here, because the backdrop is that we've had a dramatic tightening in financial conditions leading up to the last week. And there are a lot of people that are making comparisons to the 08 financial crisis, not in specific terms, but in the kind of general terms. And of course, like Bear Stearns was purchased by JP Morgan in March. And there's just a lot of anxiety around what institutions in financial markets are going to be impacted and how badly as a result of the underlying tightening credit conditions. And is there a lot more to see? And I'm curious, like, how much stock you put in that. And when you hear comparisons to 08, what do you think is an appropriate comparison? What is it? Do you have any views on that?
Well, maybe the appropriate comparison is more the savings and loan debacle, you know, from 1989 to 1993. It's more like the S&L crisis. I said before, being an economic historian, lightning doesn't strike twice. So everybody, and I know this, will always go fight the last war. So everybody's comparing it to 08 and 09. And as we headed into 08, people were saying it's going to be as bad as the dot-com crisis. When we ended the dot-com crisis, they're all saying it's going to be as bad as the savings and loan crisis.
Sure.
People just remember, because that's their memory bank.
Is the S&L crisis a better comparison because of the regional banks that are involved in this?
Yes, but there's differences. But this is definitely not 08 and 09. And it's a crazy comparison. It's just what people seem to remember. The 08-09 were these low-quality residential mortgages, highly levered, mezzanine CDOs that were being sold off and repackaged. Nobody knew the exposures on their balance sheets, and nobody understood the counterparty risk. So we got to a situation at the peak of the anxiety where no bank trusted any other bank. You got to understand, these banks do business with each other. They do business with each other in the overnight market. They help fund each other. There was no trust in the system, right? Because of counterparty risk.
And also difficulty in valuing the underlying assets. Today, the assets in question, for example, with Silicon Valley Bank, wasn't a question of how much to value them. It's just that they were upside down because of the rising interest rate environment. There was a duration mismatch on the bonds.
Right.
Of course, regional banks do have a loan portfolio, and there are huge questions about how to value that, which is something I do want to get into with you.
100%. We have to separate what is a crisis caused by interest rate risk and what is a crisis that's caused by credit risk. So that was all about credit and gaping holes in bank balance sheets. So the answer is we haven't got there. We're probably not going to get there because the big banks spent so many years in the penalty box, were restricted on their lending, restricted on their dividends for a prolonged period of time there. The big banks are much better supervised, regulated, and you're 100% right. As complex as they are, and they're still complex institutions and always will be, their capitalization levels, their liquidity buffers, and the quality of their assets, it's not even comparable. So it's not 08-09. But so what? If I tell you it's not 08-09 and I tell you it's more like 1989-90, does that make you feel any better? We have a situation on our hands. Now, right now, the focus has just been on the liabilities. It's, as you said, asset liability mismatch, 100% true. Although, does anybody really know what was left on whether it's Signature Bank or whether it was Silicon Valley Bank, you know, what other assets were on their balance sheets that all of a sudden it took so long for anybody to start picking these apart? My big concern is this. what's normal? Because what we're seeing right now is not normal. It's not normal. It's not normal to have the banking crisis come before the recession. The recession normally invokes the financial crisis because the recession impairs cash flows and impairs debt servicing capacity. Cycle after cycle after cycle.
So how do we know we're not already in recession?
Well, because if you look at the broad measures of the business cycle, which is real personal income, excluding government transfers, industrial production, employment, and real manufacturing, wholesale, and retail sales, they are pretty well close. But no, the recession is not starting. The recession, if you look at the actual components of the economy that feed into an NBER-defined recession, it hasn't started yet. And everybody's so tempestuous. No, it hasn't started yet. The lags between the inverted yield curve and the recession, basically it's going to start Q2 or Q3.
So what does it mean that we're seeing banking stress or stress in the banking system before the recession has actually started?
Well, because as you said, we just came off the most pernicious interest rate shock since 1981. I don't know. If I remember correctly, 81 was followed by 82. Nobody was calling for recession in 82 except for Gary Schilling, who got fired for it for the second time at Merrill Lynch for daring to declare a recession that he was right on.
Gary's also been on the show as well.
Well, Gary's a dear friend of mine, and he's also been on my podcast. But let me just say that we had a massive interest rate shock. And this is what we're seeing as the early signs of that, the early signs of the rate shock. What this rate shock is going to do, and what you already started to see, and this was before the mess in the banking industry in the past couple of weeks, was the banks, large and small, were already starting to tighten their credit standards at a rate that we last saw in the opening months of 2020, before then 2008, before then 2001, before then 1990. So the banks, in the context of an inverted yield curve, we're only in an inverted yield curve historically 15% of the time. It is an abnormal state of affairs. And when you get an inverted yield curve, which everybody says to ignore, funky things happen. I couldn't believe, I'll tell you the truth. At the last summer, when the curve started to invert, I said in my morning note, here's my forecast. My forecast will be that the yield curve is going to invert. Now I look at twos, tens, despite all its impurities. And I was said that every Tom, Dick, and Harry economist on Wall Street is going to try and convince you to ignore the inverted yield curve. Oh, when the curve is steepening into recovery, oh, the yield curve is wonderful. No. But you see, when it's inverting, best to ignore it. And then we had the temerity of Jay Powell when it inverted. And he was asked at one of the meetings last summer, what do you think of the inverted yield curve? He says, oh, we've concocted our own yield curve, which is the 3 month forward, 18 months out, and it's not inverted yet. Although, as of today, it's inverted, but nobody talks about it. Pretty well more than 80% of all the yield curves are inverted. And so when you're taking a look at magnitude of the inversion, you look at the depth, duration, and the dispersion of the yield curves that are inverted, 100% chance, not 80, not 90. And this is tough for me to say, because I always preach that we don't live in a world of probabilities where anything is zero or anything is 100. There's always shades of gray. But unfortunately, I have to extricate myself from my own preaching in that regard, because everything I'm seeing is telling me that the recession is basically 100% ironclad at this point. The banks are already tightening their credit standards. Now, I got to understand here, the U.S. economy is a credit-driven economy more than any other economy on the planet. It is a credit-driven economy. And the banks were already telling you before the crisis that they were tightening in the reins, not at a normal rate, but at a rate in the past that was consistent with previous recessions. Which maybe is why Brian Moynihan came out and told us recently that it looks like recessions Q3, Q4, a bank CEO, whoever does that. Even Jamie Dimon was sort of flipping around at the same time. This is a couple of weeks ago. You have a bank CEO telling you Q3, Q4. I think more Q2, Q3, but that's not like Chase Nichols under the steamroller. It's staring us in the face.
It's also a lot easier making that projection today when you have a central bank that's really focused on bringing it about. I mean, isn't that a big part of where your certainty comes from, the fact that the Fed has been trying to engineer a recession?
Well, I had that sense actually when they first started tightening in March of 2022, when during the press conference, after the first rate hike, which was almost exactly a year ago, he came out and said, Powell, in the Q&A, that we are no longer focusing on the supply side of the economy. And I guess it was a case of once burnt, twice shy, that after all these recurring shocks, not just the pandemic, but the variants, and then we had China, God forbid, getting two cases of COVID, which shut down port cities of 20 million that were critical to the supply chain. And then we had the war, the Putin war in the Ukraine, ongoing supply shocks, ongoing inflationary supply shocks. And he says, enough is enough. But when he said that, I was saying at the time, let's examine this for a second. The most important man on the planet, the head of the Fed, is telling us he's not focused on the supply curve. Well, how do you forecast inflation with one curve? The first thing you learn in economics 101, is that prices are established by the intersection of two curves, supply and demand. In this case, we're talking about inflation. So we're talking about aggregate supply and aggregate demand, two very big curves. And he's saying, I suppose that we're just going to assume that the supply curve, whether it's of labor or of products, because don't forget, we also had a very frustratingly disappointing recovery in the participation rate for a whole host of reasons. Although now it's starting to come back very nicely, I might add. But they're saying, we're not focused on hoping the supply side is going to come back and become more inelastic. Told me at the time, we're focused on the demand curve. Well, excuse me. What is GDP? It's aggregate demand. And so it told me right away that, yes, he was surreptitiously telling us you're going to engineer the conditions for a recession. I guess they'll hope that it's going to be a mild one, but that's how they're going to kill the inflation. But what's happened all the while is take a look at the supply delivery delay indices in these surveys, taking a look at global freight rates, shipping rates, cargo volumes, two-way flows out of the ports of LA and Long Beach. And now you're seeing it in producer prices and commodity prices, but they don't talk about that. And so the supply side has already thawed. So they're focused on the demand side. Now we had the reopening of the economy. We had everybody going out, having a good time, casinos, hotels, airlines, restaurants. And we're getting actually to the tail end of that. So we have to remember here that, yes, we had a Fed that was focused on one curve. They basically told us we don't control the supply curve. We're going to focus on demand. Well, the only way you're going to get inflation down to 2%. And to this day, we've done a whole bunch of research showing that historically the sweet spot for the economy, the periods of the greatest economic stability and growth and financial market stability and prosperity was not a 2% inflation. It was when inflation was 3 to 4. But God forbid, and these inflation numbers like the CPI, over 40% of it is imputed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's pure guesswork. Financial services is guesswork. Health services is guesswork. And we know that rents and OER are basically survey-based data with no reliability, but there's also built-in distributive lags. So the bottom line in all this is that the Fed overeased and now they've over-tightened. And the overeased led to, along with fiscal policy, a temporary boom and a temporary inflation that we're willing to say in the overall annals of economic history, 18 months is temporary. I guess when you live in real time, it doesn't feel so temporary. And now they've made another mistake as a mirror image in the other direction in terms of over-tightening, creating the conditions, I think, for deflation. And I think you're quite right, and a recession. But it comes down to the question you asked before about the financial sector. Normally, a recession is what causes the financial crisis. Washington Mutual, 2008, right? 1982. Penn Square Bank, 84, Connell, Illinois. We had 2001, Superior Bank. You know, we had in 1991, the Bank of New England. The recession causes these. The recession started in December of 2007. Bear Stearns did not take place in June of 2007. Bear Stearns took place in February and March of 2008. Fannie and Freddie took place in June and July of 2008, and then we know what happened with Lehman and with AIG and Mother Merrill in September of 2008. this is what the recession causes. These things happen after the recession, which is staring us in the face. That's what has me concerned, is all this stuff is happening in real time.
Right.
In advance of the recession. Now, there's only one other sample size where this happened in advance of the recession. You know when that was? The savings and loan crisis, which followed an aggressive tightening by the Greenspan Fed. People talk, oh, Alan Greenspan, the maestro, the Greenspan put, the Greenspan put, the Greenspan put. Greenspan was like, took over from Volcker. Guns a-blazing. Well, then we had the crash of 87. And then, of course, we had the debacle in commercial real estate because he raised rates aggressively, inverted the yield curve. Back then, I'll tell you right now, as the Bank of Nova Scotia, 1989, don't worry about the yield curve. Don't worry about the yield curve. Don't worry about the yield curve. Yeah. And next thing you know, we have a savings and loan crisis on our hands. That didn't impair bank capital amongst the big banks. Although, let me just tell you that earnings in the bank system went down. And if your game is relative performance, yeah, own JP Morgan, it was only down 20%. But meanwhile, the regional banks were down 50%. So this is actually a very important message right now, because the problem, and remember that we had a four-year workout period. We had a three-quarter recession. We had a bear market in equities. Bond yields came crashing down over a four-year period, and the Fed cut the funds rate from 9 7/8 down to 3. And then all Greenspan is talking about in 1993, more than 2 years after the official recession ended, is talking about 60-mile-an-hour headwinds. There was almost no recovery whatsoever. Now, inevitably, they kept the system flush for long enough. We worked through the problems, created RTC. A third of the savings loan industry was taken out of the system. We had restructuring, consolidation, because nothing is permanent, as my hero Bob Farrell says. And we moved on. In 1994, 95, 96, well, then we had the internet craze. Nobody was talking about the savings loan crisis anymore. But I'll tell you something. It had a weight on the economy. But you see, back then, the small banks were small. The small banks back then, I'm talking about the late 80s, early 90s, had assets collectively of $500 billion. The lesson we're learning, Silicon Valley Bank just happened to be one of the biggest banks. And we have these regional banks. And of course, First Republic is now the Alamo. That's, these small banks have become too big. You see what I'm saying? Their assets now are $7 trillion. Small banks back in the late 80s, early 90s were not systemic. And even though they weren't systemic, they created the conditions for a multi-year credit crunch and a recession nobody expected. And the Fed taking the funds rate from 9 7/8 in 1989, down to 3% by 1992, was in nobody's forecast. Just like everybody thinks to say today, inflation, 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 higher for longer, higher for longer. None of that's going to happen. So the way I see it is that, unusually, we have a banking crisis on our hands, and it is. And at a time when the economy was already making a transition because of the inverted yield curve, from expansion to stagnation to recession. I mean, the economy is not the stock market. It moves glacially. That everything we're seeing, including Silicon Valley Bank, came as a result of the rug being taken from underneath them from the Fed's aggressive rate hikes and the inverted yield curve. But we haven't seen the economic impact yet. The banks are already tightening their credit standards before all this happened. And that, to me, was, woo, a wake-up sign in its own right. Imagine what's going to happen now as the banks, and not just the small banks, but the money center banks, will be focused on ensuring that their balance sheets are pristine. What comes out of this is greater regulation. What comes out of this with certainty is a higher level of funding cost for the banking sector. And what comes out of this is a focus on preserving balance sheets at the expense of net new lending for an economy that's built on credit. So that's going to be the next chapter in this story, is not about, oh, well, deposits were so many concentration of uninsured deposits. The story's not going to be, oh, we had a mismatch between interest rate product on our assets and deposits. No. It's going to be about what happens to asset quality on the other side of the balance sheet, as the recession ensnares debt service capacities and creates the conditions for a rising trend in loan delinquencies and defaults, which, by the way, is already starting. You know, so what do? I'm always looking. I said before, I connect the dots. I'm not looking at default rates right now. I'm told, default rates, but they're so low. Yeah. I'm looking at the feeder. I'm looking at the early signs of stress. You know, like if you were actually focused in early 07 on the ABX market, you would have known what was going to be happening a year later. So I'm noticing 30-day late payment rates, autos, credit cards, C&I loans, CRE, you know, 29% of regional bank assets are in commercial real estate, which I think is the accident that's going to be happening.
So that's what I'm going to move us to the second part, David, and that's what I want to talk about, not just commercial real estate and housing, but also unemployment and joblessness forecasts, because again, you have so much research and you put forward forecasts for different sectors and also parts of the economy. Gold, you're very bullish on gold, and I want to talk to you about that because gold looks like it might be coming out of its slump now. Mm-hmm. Oil has been extremely weak recently, and I wonder, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, when do cyclically sensitive commodities like oil tend to bottom? Where in the recession do they tend to bottom? Because I know that you're very bullish on it long term. So, and also, what is it? How does the commodity bottom relative to the equity, and what are the opportunities there? I'm also curious about farmland, because you wrote a little bit about this, and I feel like one of the challenges for investing in farmland is also dealing with climate risk.
Right.
Because even though climate is systemic, it manifests in idiosyncratic ways. And are there ways to maybe invest in farmland that diversify risk so that you don't have exposure to any particular part of the country? Anyway, those are just like kind of some of the things I had written out. But we're going to get into the second part of the conversation, David. For anyone new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener supported. We don't accept advertisers or commercial sponsors. The entire show is funded from top to bottom by listeners like you. If you want access to the second hour of today's conversation with David, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and sign up to one of our three content tiers. All subscribers gain access to our premium feed, which you can use to listen to the rest of today's conversation on your mobile device using your favorite podcast app, just like you're listening to this episode right now. David, stick around. We're going to move the second hour onto the premium feed. If you want to listen in on the rest of today's conversation, head over to hiddenforces.io/subscribe and join our premium feed. If you want to join in on the conversation and become a member of the Hidden Forces Genius community, you can also do that through our subscriber page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. You can follow me on Twitter at Kofinas, and you can email me at info@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.